One thing that has been incredibly exciting in my own garden, which I have been posting on Instagram, is that we now have, in my very ordinary urban garden, we have a resident hedgehog.
Oh, and lovely.
I'm so excited.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Phil.
And this is The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals. Each week, we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. So, without further ado, let's get down and dirty. So today on the Underground podcast, we are delighted to be joined by Debbie Holland. And Debbie Holland is a professional gardener. She's also a garden writer and photographer and a content creator. So Debbie, welcome to the Underground.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, welcome, Debbie.
It's great to have you. It's lovely.
Thank you very much.
So let's crack on with the first question. Can you tell us a little bit about your life before horticulture?
Yes, sure. Like lots of us, we had very diverse career paths before horticulture, which is as more people I speak to, I find lots of people also have come to horticulture a little bit later in life. So going right back to the beginning, I started, went to art college, studied art and graphic design, and then moved into, I did a degree in media, specialising in documentary making. And then after that, I was very lucky to go on some nice exotic holidays with my family, and I got to train as a scuba diver when we went on our travels to Mexico and Jamaica.
Wow, brilliant.
That certainly led the sort of foundation of being interested in tropical plants, because obviously I hadn't seen things like that before, so that was great to explore. And another very unusual kind of experience I was lucky to have is that we did go to Venezuela and traveled to the rainforest, which was fantastic. Mind-blowing. And to be honest, that really stayed with me, as you can imagine, and has really kind of shook me to my core about how vast it was and all these amazing diverse creatures and plants that are there. So I've taken that forward with me. But in terms of studying, I went all the way through with my Paddy Dive Master course, and I studied in Brighton and became a professional diver. So worked at a school in Brighton. And then I wanted to kind of amalgamate the diving with my media studies and managed to get a job in the New Forest working for a underwater film company, which is a bit, bit random, you know.
But that's niche.
As you do.
I know, it was quite bizarre when I look back on it now. And I got to work with a lot of very interesting people on a lot of different things, from pop promos to films to commercials and documentaries, and wow, really experienced just some random things working with people like Davina McCall and Julian Clary and Richard Branson's Round the World Balloon Challenge. And some favorite highlights were working with Placebo and safety diving Tori Amos and Bjork. So
oh my goodness.
All those things were really bizarre and it, a lifetime ago now, but I'm so glad they happened, because of I think everything you experience when you're younger, you draw on those elements and move them forward with you. You never lose them, but I think life is all about evolving in different phases. And then later moved to Bath and worked for 12 years in the Sports Training Village, which is an Olympic and Paralympic training centre. So started as a PA and then went on to be their website manager after I had my son. And it was absolutely fantastic. I learned an awful lot. And we worked very, very closely with the press office and covering events, taking photos of events, interviewing athletes. And it really kind of, I learned to work quickly with a fast turnaround of information and and network. I love people. I love chatting. I love people. And, you know, that was just wonderful, because you get to meet so many people. And then, you know, to actually coherently try and coordinate all that information so that people can, you know, access it, from grassroots up to Olympic and Paralympic athletes. So it's been quite a journey of different things. So it's quite funny how your life can take lots of turns and twists, and then you end up in horticulture.
Well, that leads me on to my next question. I mean, I could listen to you talk about your past all day. It's fascinating because I've had a bit of a quirky past myself, and people say, oh my gosh, so how come you're a gardener? And I remember saying, you know, if my 18-year-old self could see me now, I'd just be horrified, you know, that I'm getting dirty and gardening and all that kind of thing. So after that, you know, all this kind of experience that you've had, what on earth led you into the world of horticulture?
I'm very lucky. I've got a nice garden at home. And I think when we moved into, it's the first house we've ever owned. Mm. And we moved in, it was quite a wild garden, and discovered there was a greenhouse as we literally uncovered it. We didn't even know one was there. And I really sort of threw myself into it. It was so exciting to suddenly have my own space. And like I say, a lot of our family members, you know, they come from farming backgrounds. So I'd sort of had it, you know, in the family, like my mom and dad grew up on farms, my husband's grandparents grew up on farms. And so I've always sort of had that background and influence of that, you know, all the, and also my grandparents had a lovely house in, or a lovely garden in Sussex with an orchard. And, you know, the classic kind of happy memories of running around there when you're younger, getting lost all in the nooks and crannies, and, you know, greenhouses full of deliciously smelling, you know, tomatoes. So I guess that sort of thing is when you then get a little bit older and then you have a child of your own, it's that kind of history repeating itself. So I, you know, created some raised beds in our garden and just had lots of rows of vegetables and salad that we could grow at home. Right. Then I could show my son how to grow, and, you know, you get your hands dirty and then you go and harvest potatoes, and seeing their little face, you know, kind of, it was really wonderful to, you know, show them where food comes from. It's not just from a supermarket. And then out of the blue, my name came up on an allotment, which I'd had my name on for a couple of years. And it was kind of a surprise when it happened. It was in October. And I literally spent every single day on this allotment. And I mean, it was chaos. It was, you know, bindweed, nettles, you name it. It was every weed known to man. And but I loved it. It was just my little sanctuary. And I really can't sort of express enough the value of having, you know, if you're lucky enough to have your own space or an allotment, of spending time there. It's very healing, you know. It's a lot of thought time, and as well as having time on your own, of course, it's a great community. So you've got the people there that you can have a good chat with and explore ideas. And then talking with a few really nice gardener friends I had who are a great influence on me, they were sort of saying, well, you know, why don't you look into gardening or so forth, because it's something you can really get your teeth into. There's so much to learn, you know. It's like years and years and years and years and years of enjoyment, really. So I started looking up jobs, and I discovered that most of them required RHS qualifications to actually get the sort of paid work. And so my husband was incredibly supportive, and he said, well, why don't you just book yourself on one? And I was like, oh, really? You know, so anyway, I did. And obviously I had to wait quite a while for the course to come up. But in the meantime, I thought, I need to get some proper hands-on experience from professionals. So locally to me, we have a National Trust property called Tintsfield. And I contacted them, and they were looking for volunteers. And so I became one of the girls on Monday mornings to go and work in the walled kitchen garden as a harvester. Oh, yeah. And it was utter bliss. It was just my dream to have that on a Monday morning, to go and you go and have your team meeting, and we all get allocated what, you know, fruit and vegetables we're going to go and collect that day. And then got to drive this really quirky little, I think it's called a Piaggio. It goes about 20 miles an hour, and we'd chug along the estate, you know, taking all the fruit and vegetables up to the cafe so that they used all the organic vegetables and fruit. And it was just absolutely amazing. And of course, I was then learning from the professional gardeners there, which was absolutely invaluable. So at the same time, because I don't like doing things by half, I as well as having a young son and juggling all the primary school stuff, I decided to start up my own business. So I started small initially, just working for family friends in their gardens. But I soon discovered that being a female gardener was quite sought after, and it just kind of exploded, really. I'm very, very grateful. So locally, yeah, suddenly I was sort of rushed off my feet, and every garden I was working in, you learn something new. And I was really learning on my feet in the beginning, and I'd be coming home and studying my books, and, you know, every time maybe a plant I didn't know or a process I didn't understand, I'd go home, I'd read it. And you know, I do very much like studying and researching. Right. Really enjoyed that. And then in the September of that year, so I'd already been doing it for about sort of 10 months, I started my course, the theory at Bristol Botanic Gardens.
Oh, lovely.
Which is absolutely wonderful. And then the practical side was down in Cannington Walled Garden, but the colleges Bridgewater and Taunton College. And as a combo, they were absolutely phenomenal because I had the best of both worlds. I got the practical side of it so I could learn all the theory. And then at the end of the week, I'd go down to campus and I could go and put those skills into practice, actually physically doing it, which was such a benefit. So, yeah, highly recommend. You know, if people want to find out about it, and you know, that RHS diploma was fantastic.
Right. Wow. Well, so you mentioned there that you've got your RHS diploma and you've been constantly studying and researching. And how important do you think that is for developing your career, or anybody wanting to develop a career in horticulture, or, you know, and compare that to maybe the sort of things that you can pick up from Instagram or whatever?
I think it's really fundamental to get your knowledge grounded and understand, you know, the facts, if you like. But I do also feel that, you know, everybody learns in different ways, and Instagram certainly has, and YouTube certainly has a really important role to play these days. There's many reasons as well. I mean, lots of people, you know, they might not necessarily want to go all the way to doing a full-time professional gardener role. They might be just wanting to expand their role within their own personal enjoyment. Also, it's like Instagram can provide so many wonderful, you know, answers, and the community of sharing information, and basically, you know, people have a go. That's the most important thing. Make gardening as accessible as possible. But the only thing I'd say is be a little bit cautious about is, I personally, if I see something, I always want it backed up. So I don't always necessarily take something as read if I've seen something. I'd see something, oh, that's really interesting. Then I'll go and look it up in my books at home. Then I'll go and Google it and double check and cross-reference it against everything. And, you know, it's kind of like dotting the I's and T's, but just to make sure that the information you're being fed, that somebody probably in very good faith is describing to somebody, but it might not necessarily be correct. So just kind of cover yourself, just sort of check. But if you're just sort of doing it at home for fun, then just give it a go. Because to be honest, it's far more important to just get stuck in and enjoy it rather than being sort of frightened and thinking, oh, I can't because I'm not sure if that's the correct way of doing something.
As Kate alluded to in her introduction, you wear an awful lot of hats. And one thing that people may know you from is as a garden writer. Can you just let us know how you got into that?
Yes, well, yeah, it's funny how things turn out, isn't it? I've always loved writing, even from a child. And so when I started gardening for my clients, lots of them were always, I sort of became a bit of an advisor as well. They're always asking me lots of advice and, you know, and with, you know, border design and everything like this. And so I thought, right, I'm going to do a monthly newsletter that just goes out to my clients, actually. So that's where it started. And I did the laborious way of, you know, setting it all out. I printed it all off in the envelopes. And then every time I'd go around to a client, I'd drop them their, you know, monthly newsletter. So did that for quite a while, and then decided, oh, I want to take this a bit further. I've got lots to say, and I love visiting gardens, and I love finding plants in wild places. And I just needed like an avenue to sort of vent that, if you like. So created a website. A dear friend of mine who's an illustrator did a fabulous branding for me, which I'm immensely grateful for. And I started writing a diary blog on there. So that was a wonderful way for me to kind of get my thoughts down, and also a good sort of a place to put my photos, because I love taking photos, but rather than them just kind of floating around in iCloud or whatever, it's nice to have them, you know, actually
on display
and, you know, sharing with people. That's the most important thing, is just you can share these things with people. So that came about. And then I entered a competition, the actual kind of getting through to becoming a garden writer. I entered a competition for Richard Jackson Gardens. Okay. And I won, and actually won twice, 2 years on the trot. And from that, they had a look at my diary blog and then invited me to write features for them, because they were really happy with what they saw. So I was, well, absolutely over the moon. And it just shows you actually that also doing these things, you know, because sometimes we're all in our own little kind of cyber worlds, if you like, and you can sometimes feel, oh, gosh, am I just talking to myself?
Kate and I feel like that all the time.
But it's like, ooh.
Let me just, so Phil, in case you don't know, so Richard Jackson, you might know him, he was QVC Flower Power, but also Richard Jackson started up Greenfingers Charity, which not
that
a lot
Richard
of people
Jackson.
Know.
Right.
So,
yes.
Yeah, so okay. Very influential. Yeah. And I've met him once. He seems a lovely, lovely man. Mm. So, yeah, very knowledgeable as well. So Flower Power, I
yes,
think.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so then there's another couple of avenues, Plantsmith and Garden News. So Garden News was the next one. I've always been a fan of Garden News magazine. And when my son was really young, I used to take photos of us doing things. And it might have been Sawyer, my son, you know, sowing seeds or something. Mm-hmm. And we'd send them in to the readers page. And it turned out that kind of like every other week or every week we were kind of being posted in there, which was tremendously exciting. I can't, you know. So, and then, you know, my family would see them and it was just all really nice. But they said, oh, we do have a voluntary role, which was writing a column every month on your own garden, which was called Over the Fence. Mm-hmm. So I did that and I absolutely loved it. And I did that for 2.5 years. So it was quite amazing. So again, I kept persevering. And then they contacted me and a position had come up on their What to Do in the Garden This Week team. And so I joined that and I've been doing that ever since, which I'm absolutely over the moon. I love doing it. And then the last one that I'm extremely proud of as well is houseplants. I'm an absolute houseplant addict, and Plantsmith was the, is the other element to my main element up to my writing that I do. And actually Plantsmith is an offshoot of Richard Jackson Garden. It was formulated by his son.
I didn't know that. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so he has created this incredible range of vegan, cruelty-free houseplant food and care products. And I was writing some houseplant articles for Richard Jackson, and then it kind of just naturally came about that they needed somebody to write posts there. So I am now the editor of Plantsmith, of their care and advice and care blog, which is fabulous. So I'm very, 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 you know, enthusiastic about that.
And is that the bottles behind you?
Oh, yes, it is actually.
Because really love their packaging. They almost look like kind of aromatherapy, don't they?
Yes.
It's a lovely concept.
It's so beautiful. I have to say, I am really, really taken with the packaging. The bottles are beautiful.
Yes, they really are, aren't they?
Yeah.
So leading on from that, Debbie, so you're a professional gardener and you work 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. So what is it that keeps you gardening for other people rather than kind of pursuing more of the media roles?
Well, it does complement my writing very, you know, seamlessly as well, which is great. I think it's really, personally for me, I find it's really important to have my hands in the soil.
Right.
I love the balance between doing the writing and also being a practical gardener as well, because it keeps me really in tune with literally, well, you know what it's like. It's every day, really, every week, something changes. You're never going to get bored. And I love being able to be immersed in that, have that connection with nature, so that I really, really do understand firsthand what's going on in the garden that week, because I've physically seen it. You know, I'm seeing what pollinators are around or not. You know, we've all been a little bit concerned about the reduced numbers in pollinators this year, but also on a positive side, I have, you know, when you're sort of working really closely with it, or you're going on walks, you know, a lot of my walks they're all based around nature and getting out there, and then you do sort of see things as they're happening, so you get a real grasp on the concept of you know what's actually happening in our environment right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that's what keeps me gardening. It's, you know, the connection with nature, and then these wonderful friendships with people. I've been through so much with all these lovely people I work with, and mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got so many benefits, gardening really, and you know, plants in general. Right. Are just so positive.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
That's lovely. So you describe yourself as an organic wildlife gardener. Mm-hmm. I think you have touched on this a bit, but why mm-hmm. why is it so important to you, and do you have any good tips that can encourage wildlife into people's gardens?
I'm really passionate about organic gardening and looking after wildlife. And with all the kind of horrifying, scary news in the past of, you know, declining wildlife, insects, pollinators, and our wildflower meadows in huge decline since, you know, the 50s. And so I think a lot of people have been really proactive in trying to turn this around. And sometimes I can feel really overwhelmed by all the things that are going on with, you know, climate change yeah. and the environment. And I think it's important to try and think that we can help one garden at a time. So this is where I kind of try and be a positive influence, like with the people I work for, the clients I work for, because one garden at a time, we can make a really interesting changes that make a big difference. Like we planted a native hedge with bare root whips, a huge length of the garden. And that was about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And it's grown, it's, you know, completely filled in. Mm-hmm. And it's this incredible, you know, native hedge of variety of all different plants, and it's full of birds, it's full of insects. And lovely. if you see results in action, I think that's where you can also encourage others to take part. And yeah. One thing that has been incredibly exciting in my own garden, which I have been posting on Instagram, is that we now have, in my very ordinary urban garden, we have a resident hedgehog.
And oh, lovely.
I'm so excited.
Very jealous.
Oh my goodness. I literally couldn't believe it. And he's been living in my greenhouse. Well, he or her, I don't know, but I'm going to say he. But living in my greenhouse. Oh. So the greenhouse is now out of bounds. But it's interesting. Our garden, it's evolved. And it's like when you say about sort of tips that you can do to encourage wildlife into your garden, I've mm-hmm. found that over the years, there's lots of things that have really made a massive difference. So I'm a no-dig gardener. Right. So the garden just kind of, you know, I add things to it, and I mulch, love mulch. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I know you love mulch. And peat-free is also essential to me. So, you know, making your own compost. Mm. And I'm, every year I've done no-mow May with plant life, and that also morphs into June and July. But what we do, yeah, is, and it's just had such a huge impact on the amount of insects that are in our garden. And then what we did this year, it was just mowed some paths into the back garden, because it was initially more No More May was all about the front garden, but this year we've also embraced it in the back rather than just having the borders. Mm-hmm. Put these paths in. And and the other thing is also planting a very diverse, amount of plants. You know, you want a good variety because different insects are attracted to different plants. So say, for example, if you're even just thinking about bees, I don't know if you know, have different length tongues. And so different bees. So, for example, if you planted foxgloves, you know, the long tongued bees can get into those tubular flower trumpets, whereas other ones are much more favour very open, singular flowers, like you have a single flower dahlia or something. Mm-hmm. So if you provide, it's important, don't get too hung up on, oh gosh, which is the precise plant I need to, just plant a variety of things and you will be covering all bases because of that. You'll be attracting different insects in that are attracted to that flower. And then the offshoot of that is because when you do have more insects coming into your garden, you get hedgehogs if you're lucky. Yeah. Or we also have resident bats that seem to live in the garden next to us, but we are very lucky that we get the whole display every evening about 10 o'clock at night when they fly around. So then you think, goodness, when you see results, you see, your garden has become an ecosystem. Yeah. You realize, wow, yeah.
It's you're invested it. In it, aren't you?
Absolutely, yes. And you're like, goodness, the things, not using pesticides. I never use pesticides. The feed I use on my garden is organic seaweed, or I make nettle or comfrey feed. And it's just keeping things simple, and letting things kind of naturally evolve. Yep. And it's quite surprising what can happen.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, brilliant.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but in the meantime, it's time for Kate's Corner, where we discover the musings and sage advice from the Gardener Guru. So, Kate, what are you going to be discussing this week?
Oh, I'm going to be talking about deadheading.
deadheading.
Absolutely. So deadheading is super important if you are growing lots of flowers, especially plants like dahlias, cosmos, sweet peas. Basically, a flower, what they want to do is they want to flower and then they want to set seed because they want to reproduce like everything else on this planet. We need to stop them reproducing because once they do that, they stop flowering for us.
Oh,
so the way
right.
we do it is by cutting off the dying flower heads before they can set seed. So what that does is just gives you lots more flowers and it also keeps them compact. And what you need is a really nice sharp pair of snips. And don't just cut just right behind where the flower is. Mm-hmm. Go down to the next set of leaves on your plant and snip all that off. Otherwise, what you end up with is a bit of straggly stem that dies back. You're not going to get a new flower on the right next to where the old one is. So deadhead your flowers. If you've got hanging baskets or lots of geraniums, pelargoniums, keep deadheading because that will get more and more flowers. And the beauty is with sweet peas and dahlias, if you pick them, then you will enjoy them, in the house as well in a vase. A little tip with dahlias, though, don't ever cut a dahlia to bring into the vase if it's not in flower because they don't open up in the vase inside. They need to be in flower. Don't have to be full flower, but definitely flowering.
So not buds.
So yeah, deadhead those beautiful flowers.
Wonderful. Thanks, Kate.
You're welcome.
And back to the show. So Debbie, as you know, on this podcast, we've been delving into the world of peat tree gardening.
Yeah.
And as you alluded to there, that you're a keen advocate of peat free. Mm-hmm. How have your gardening clients sort of taken to that? Are they on board with you? Do you have to use some persuading?
No, well, it's brilliant because they are really on board with it. And because I never force my views on anybody because I do think it's really important that everybody's opinion and everybody's garden is their own sanctuary. So I'm very respectful that, people might not have the same opinions as me or the same gardening practices that they want to undertake as me. But luckily, because I do talk about peat-free and organic wildlife gardening, everybody's kind of rolled with it. And yes. So things have evolved over the years. And, you know, the gardens that I work in, we, each one of them, actually, we all have multiple compost heaps, which is absolutely wonderful. Ones for all garden waste, and then also for collecting leaf mold. You know, we make leaf mold, which is just absolutely wonderful for improving soil structure and adding nutrition. And so if you're not, you can cut down the requirement for a start on needing to buy anything in if you make your own compost. Now, I appreciate not everybody may have room, and that's completely understandable. But there are other systems that you can purchase now, which you can, even if you've got like a balcony or something, you can have little smaller composting systems on your balcony. That's one thing I'd really say, is if you can have a compost heap, that's absolutely fantastic, because you're generating all your own growing medium without having to buy it in. That also cuts down on plastic, because you're not having to buy in, you know, compost in plastic bags. Said that, there are also lots of companies now that are producing wonderful peat-free products, and again, it's a bit of trial and error. Some are better than others, and you just need to kind of experiment a little bit and see what works for you. So I'd say that's really out there, whereas it used to be really, really difficult to find peat-free compost in garden centres. And it's still, sometimes I'm surprised, the ratio, and you're thinking, goodness, come on. But I am seeing it more and more now that the it's shifting, that there's more, you know, demand. So thankfully it's being listened to. And then the other thing I'll say is I really love hiking, and I do an awful lot. I'm very lucky. I do a lot of hiking in the Lake District and Brecon Beacons and Dartmoor when I get a chance and next more. But what I found really important is when I am on these hikes, particularly say in the Lake District, which I've been lucky enough to come back from recently, is actually seeing peat in situ in its natural environment is a game changer. Because it hosts such a diverse collection of plants and wildlife. And when I've been privy to seeing it, you just think, leave it there. You can't, I truly can't bear the thought of it being all dug up just to go in some bags to be put in someone's garden. It just seems ludicrous.
It doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
You're digging up plants in order to have plants.
Yeah, to put plants, which is just completely counterintuitive. Yeah. So when one plant that I was absolutely desperate to come across and see again was sundew. And on my recent trip, they were, I've gone from sundew being like a rare sighting where I've seen it about once in the Lake District and I know the precise grid reference of where it is, to the other week, they were absolutely everywhere.
Oh, amazing.
And I am a bit of a kind of nerd, because good company. But I, you know, my husband's very patient, because our hikes always take so much longer than they really should, because I sprint.
You're stopping.
I know, I drive him mad. He's so,
I'm absolutely the same. In fact, I posted about a sundew I found on Dartmoor a few weeks ago.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm going to have to look that up.
I was
so excited, because they frequent kind of, the peat bogs, and you often find them running water. And they're normally, I'm very interested in plants at altitude, where plants grow at different altitudes. And they're around 200 to 250 meters. You normally naturally find them. And so when we're on our hike, I'm looking at the meter to see roughly where we are, you know, and then my eyes are peeled and I'm like Hawkeye. I'm just kind of like, you know, we're walking along, but I've got one eye on the ground trying not to fall over. And I'm looking, and I'm just looking for that sort of tinge of sort of ready foliage. And I think, there is one. And then that's it. My husband's lost me. I'm down on the ground taking photos and looking at it. And you just, it's just to actually see plants in their natural, you know, they've chosen to grow there, is really, really precious. So
it's so lovely to hear you say it, because that was me 2 weeks ago on Dartmoor. It really was. Went swimming in a lake, and that's when I saw these sundews, and I was, that was it. And exactly, it was all peatland. Seeing, and that's kind of, I did a little reel about, you know, this is peatlands, and this is this is what grows here. It might look bleak from a distance, but you get up close. And
yeah, there's so much going on, yeah. isn't there?
And then if you see a bit where that's kind of eroded a bit and you get the kind of the strata, it's just, it's amazing. Yeah. So I'm totally on your wavelength with that one. And my partner was just like, yeah, come on.
Hang on. I've been reading just recently about the Georgian and the Victorian plant hunters. And I was having a conversation with my wife just yesterday, actually. And I said, you know, the one thing that I didn't understand was the fact that when they're describing these people and they say, and they went off and they did a spot of botanizing. And I was like, I can't picture that. I can't picture what that was. And now you've said about what your trip to the Lake District and going on your walk. And I'm like, that's it. That's what it is.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
Botanizing. Yeah,
doing your spot of botanizing. Whereas
that sounds quite rude.
That sounds like it should be a t-shirt. Yes.
I'm just off botanizing.
Oh, that's brilliant.
You might have started something there. I think we're going to play.
I'm going to ask you about our pretty dismal summer. Now, yesterday afternoon, it was lovely and sunny here, not the warmest. And then I woke up this morning and I can't see the sea. And actually, there was an Instagram post this morning from quite a well-known influencer, Garden City Boy, I think, saying who else is so not into gardening at the moment because of the weather. Yeah. So, I mean, it was quite a good post, you know, but we had so many younger people who took up gardening during lockdown. And as if we can remember, it was an incredible spring and summer. Have you got any advice or tips to just keep people motivated, to keep them going, whatever the weather?
Yes, I think houseplants are the answer. We have had a very challenging weather year this year, and it can get you a bit down because, you know, normally we're used to being out in our garden from, you know, dawn to dusk and all the lovely, you know, outdoor air and tinkering around our garden, watering we're doing. But, you know, you have to sort of pick and choose your moments. My house is completely and utterly full of houseplants. And we have obviously sort of seen a real upsurge in their popularity. And, you know, young people getting involved is absolutely vital to get them interested in this whole scene, you know, the whole horticultural industry. And a lot of people obviously, they perhaps live in student halls, they're studying, or they live in a flat, or they don't own their own home. And so actual gardening in a private garden might not be something that's available to them. So I find that houseplants are such an easy gateway into the horticulture industry, because you can have as many or as little plants as you like. All you need is a windowsill or a desk, you know. And choose something that's really easy to look after so that you're not going to sort of stress yourself out with trying to keep something alive if you feel, you know, there's nothing more, you know, depressing as if you killed your plant. But yeah, there's lots of plants that are really super easy to look after. And the other thing that I find extremely interesting and will keep people's enthusiasm up is propagating, because lots of houseplants they're actually super easy to propagate, and it's a great project. And if you're kind of a bit short of money, so you can't spend loads of money on lots of houseplants, then why don't you sort of club together with some friends, you know, and each choose a different plant, and then you propagate them and then share them with
each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And
gifts of plants. I mean, who doesn't like plants as a gift? You know, it puts a smile on your face, doesn't it? So, and that sense of achievement, if you've actually managed to propagate that plant yourself, you do feel rather proud of yourself. So, yeah, my hot tip would be houseplants.
Brilliant.
So, Debbie, with all your skills and your like eclectic, amazing past that you've got, what keeps you in the world of horticulture?
Oh, it is just such an exciting industry to work in, because to be honest, I'm constantly learning. It doesn't matter how much you study, there's always something else to learn. It really is limitless. And I find that you can really absorb yourself in one element. You think, gosh, and you get really interested in a particular part or something. So I like being able to be completely immersed in a topic where I just never, ever get bored. Right. It's, you know, they say every day's a school day, but it is really true, to be honest. I've been really quite interested with the Open University.
Okay.
And that's quite a, you know, the courses are free and there's lots of horticulture courses on there that you can sort of dip into. And they're just kind of participation courses. But I've done Introduction to Ecosystems, which was absolutely fascinating. Right. And Neighbourhood Nature, that was very much about woodland management and species. And then a slightly different slant that I'm studying at the moment is the science of nutrition and healthy eating, which does also obviously lapse over because of, you know, growing what you eat and organic produce is so important. And I had a few health issues a while back and I had to really address food, what I was eating. It really made me sort of think about everything, you know, lifestyle and so forth. And it's just such a fascinating course. And of course, you can just dip in and out. And then it relates back very much. It makes you think how important organic food is and spurs you on even more to grow your own, just understanding, you know, food without pesticides and, you know. So, yes, I just love, there's just so many different facets to it. That's all I can say, really. It is limitless. It's brilliant.
No, that sounds fantastic. And that Open University stuff sounds like an amazing resource as well.
I'll write that down.
Write it down. Yeah, have a Google. It's brilliant. You'll be looking on it. And there's, as well as sort of horticulture, there's so many environmental courses as well and of varying lengths. And, there's a whole host of different topics to dip into there. So that's really, really good.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Thank you. So, Debbie, I'm going to ask one final question, and that is, what plant brings a smile to your face and why?
It's sweet peas. I find them just such a beautiful, exquisitely scented plant that it doesn't matter where I am, whose garden, I'm always drawn to the sweet peas. They look beautiful when they're just all, you know, or hanging up, growing up, whatever, climbing frames and supports they're on. And I don't think there's anything nicer than picking a bunch of sweet peas and either having your cut flowers in your own home or better still, giving them to someone. Because just recently I cut a load of bunches of sweet peas and then gave them as presents to family, and it was just seeing the smiles on their faces was so nice. That the smell's intoxicating, and I think it just kind of in a way casts us all back to our childhood in a way. It's just such the scent of summer that sweet peas always make me smile.
Fantastic. And they've been amazing this year. They've loved the water. They've loved the wet. So they've just been constantly growing.
They have been good.
They've been absolutely. Yes. And they are just beautiful.
Yes. You get so much from one plant. I think that's what's fascinating. They just, you know, just keep cut and come again and they just go on and on. So they really are worth the investment in growing from seed and bringing them, nurturing them all the way through.
So, thank you so much, Debbie, for coming to talk to us today. It's been fascinating and just so, exciting. And I love your positivity and the energy that you bring to the conversation as well. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. So, Phil, that was a lovely conversation with Debbie.
It really was. I just loved her enthusiasm for everything
passion
that she spoke about. Yeah, it really was. It came across in spades and was just so refreshing, wasn't it?
Well, I do think a lot of people we've spoken to, it is their passion that's come through. I think with Debbie, she's so eloquent and manages to put forward her thoughts and ideas so well. That makes it so engaging. So a lot of things she was saying can really relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love Debbie's, just her whole attitude towards learning, you know.
Yes.
And I thought that was great. You know, she's a lifelong learner.
Yes, I'm going to look at the Open University, definitely. And I loved the way she talked about it is important to have that knowledge base to back up what you're saying and to just go back and check. But there always is knowledge out there with horticulture, always knowledge. And it's, she said, you never stop learning.
No, absolutely. Brilliant. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Phil. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant, and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at wrightobarra.com.